So good evening. Those of you who braved the night to come here, I have been doing a series of talks on the precepts, and tonight normally would be the night to talk about not lying. However, hopefully I didn't lie by not doing it today. Since it is Halloween, I thought I'd give a more topical talk about fear and demons. And mostly references to the suttas, the discourses of the Buddha on this topic. And maybe you'll be thoroughly frightened by the time the evening's over. Maybe not. There's one discourse where the Buddha talks about fear quite a bit. And he talks about the conditions that give rise to fear. And here the example he gives is for people who go into the forest, into the dark, deep, haunted forest. And what would be the conditions for fear arising and going into the woods, into the forest. And rather than being the goblins and the ghosts and the witches in the forest, these are the conditions for the arising of fear that he lists. He gives a whole long list. And it goes, I'll abbreviate it soon, but it starts off, whenever recluses or Brahmins, impurified in bodily conduct, resort to remote jungle thickets, resting places in the forest, then owning to the defect of their unpurified bodily conduct, these good recluses and Brahmins evoke unwholesome fear and dread. So if your conduct, your physical conduct, your actions have been impure, have been causing transgression, transgression that causes harm to people, breaking the precepts, for example. That's a condition for going into the woods and feeling afraid. Then he says the same things for verbal conduct. If you're unpurified in verbal conduct or in mental conduct, if the recluse or Brahmins is covetous or full of lust, that's a condition for the giving rise of fear and dread going into the forest. If the mind if the person has the mind of ill will and intentions of hate, those are the conditions for giving rise to fear. If there's a mind that is filled with sloth and torpor, or with restlessness and unpeacefulness in mind, in uncertainty and doubting, if a person is given to self-praise and disparagement of others, if a person is desirous of gain, honor, and renown, if the person is lazy or wanting in energy, unmindful and not fully aware, unconcentrated and with straying minds. It's quite a list. So those are the causes and conditions of getting frightened on Halloween night. So here the emphasis is on the state of your mind, the state of your behavior and your conduct as being the primary condition for the rising of fear and dread. And that's we take that as a challenge, because many people, fear is something we think of, we're afraid of the external conditions. We're afraid of, we lock our doors at night because we're afraid otherwise what might happen. And here he wants to make the argument that the primary conditions for fear are these what we do with our own behavior and our own minds. And if we care for it well and develop the opposite of these qualities, then we're less likely to be afraid. So I leave that for you to think about, how the connection is between your mental state and your capacity or your tendency to feel afraid or anxious or worried. Now, there might be real things to be afraid of. And so what are things we can be afraid of? And each of you probably have your own favorite list of things that you're afraid of. in but again, here, this is very interesting what the Buddha does on fear, the things to be afraid of. The thing that's probably the most frightening thing in the world is not the Frankensteins roaming the streets, but rather is your own mind. And that's, I say that a little bit rhetorically to make a point. I mean, I don't think probably most of your minds are not that frightening. But it's the forces in your own mind that you have the most cause to be afraid of. It's the forces in your own mind which are the forces which are going to lead to your suffering, to your detriment in some kind of spiritual way. There might be physical things in the world, activities in the world, people in the world that might cause you physical harm. And certainly that's something to be apprehensive about and concerned about. But even when people do physical damage to you, the argument in Buddhism, the challenge, and you can certainly argue back and you can disagree with this, but the argument is that your spiritual life is really in your hands. And what you do, how you respond psychologically or mentally to what happens to you can be the conditions for suffering and can be the conditions for the lack of suffering, even for happiness. And so, the point here is that what you have most to fear isn't spiritually, for your spiritual well-being, is not what the conditions of the world are, but rather the conditions, again, of how your mind will respond to what goes on, what your response and activities of your own mind. Now, it's very interesting that in the teachings of the Buddha, these forces in our mind or inside of us, inner forces that we have the most to fear, are personified in a figure called Mara. And probably some of you have heard about Mara. So Mara is the Buddhist devil, or the kind of archetypical demon. And in the form of this Mara, it's seen as a personification of these forces. Mara is the externalization of forces in our own minds, external image we have of what goes on in our own mind. And it's a very interesting that the Buddha should talk about Mara, because it's quite unique in the history of Indian religions, and actually Asian religions, for a religion to have a devil-like figure. We know that in other religions that are a little bit further to the west on the globe, and that in Judaism, Christianity, and I think in Islam, there is a devil, Satan, that plays a very important role. And this is one place where Buddhism and these theistic religions of the West share a common element in having this kind of figure of the devil or Mara. But how we understand Mara is then very important. And mostly, in the teachings of the Buddha, Mara can best be understood as being a personification of inner psychic forces. Now, why personify these forces of greed, of hate, of delusion, and so forth? And one of the reasons, I think, is that some of the forces of greed that we have, lust, some of the forces of hate, hostility, ill will, some of the forces of confusion, fear that we might have, seem to arise, bubble up inside of us without our choosing them. Where did that come from? You know, you see, minding your own business, you're going down the street, and suddenly you're overwhelmed with this, you know, these desires arise, or these fears arise, or these things arise. And sometimes it's a little bit hard to feel that you're responsible for them, or that you identify with them. This is me. It's certainly not me in the sense that the part of me that I have control over, that I can choose. If I was going to choose, those parts wouldn't be there. And so it's kind of, talking about Mara as something external from oneself, at least symbolically, it's kind of pointing out that this is something that's outside of your direct choice and control. It's something that seems a little bit surprising that it should arise. These powerful forces you'd rather not have be there. And so Buddhist practice in some ways is learning how to deal with these forces that we'd rather not be there, we'd rather not own, we'd rather not wish that we wish they weren't there. If we didn't have these forces that if we could just control our lives, control our inner lives, psychological lives, say, well, that's enough, no more, I don't need any of that anymore, then we would all be enlightened within, you know, a few minutes. But we don't have that ability. There's these powerful forces moving through us often that we don't, you know, sometimes know how to deal with or get a handle on. To get a small example of this is, especially people who are new to meditation, is try to control your thinking mind. You know, if you could be in charge of your thinking mind, you'd just stop it. Your mind would stop thinking and you'd be dwelling in peace. But you can't do that so easily. And there's a kind of, your mind has a mind of its own. So this idea of Mara is this thing, the mind that has a mind of its own. It's that forces within us which are not, you know, we don't necessarily identify with for ourselves. Sometimes when I've taught, I've distinguished between two forms of, two ideas of freedom. One idea is the idea of freedom to. It's freedom to do whatever you'd like. The freedom to vote, the freedom to own property, the freedom to speech. A lot of these great freedoms we have in America. The freedom to, if that's the emphasis, the freedom, kind of a right to do things, can lend itself, can kind of shade over very quickly until it becomes something like the freedom to shop. You know, I don't want to have any limitations on my life. I have these desires, these wishes of what I want. And real freedom is when there's no limitations on my desires and I could just shop until I drop. Just follow through on every possible desire I have. The Buddhist idea of freedom is not freedom to, but freedom from. And so here it's freedom from the compulsions. So if there's a compulsion to shop, then is to have free from that compulsion. So then we're not driven by forces which are not our choosing. So freedom from fear, freedom from the forces of hate. And that's really the emphasis of Buddhism, is take away or freedom from that which moves through us, so we'd rather not be there. So the Buddha. The Buddha was visited by Mara repeatedly. And some of you maybe have never been visited by Mara. You don't think about, you don't use those ideas, those terms. But the Buddha was visited by Mara. And I'd like to suggest that the strength of which Mara existed for the Buddha was probably in direct proportion to the strength of his spiritual seeking, his spiritual exertion, spiritual endeavoring he was engaged in. From all we can tell, he was incredibly resolved and dedicated to pursue his spiritual life, to follow that spiritual life to the end. And without him having done what he did, we wouldn't be here today. There was something very powerful and significant that he discovered that apparently no one had discovered before him in the same kind of way. The powerful possibility of freedom, of purification of the heart, of liberation. And it was not an easy thing for him to have discovered. And he spent many years practicing many different spiritual traditions, and he was really dedicated, determined to do it all the way. He talked about this as being going against the currents of, well, he didn't define what the currents was, but he said the spiritual path is going against the currents. Like you're going on a river. It's easy to float down the river, but to go up river is quite hard. You have to paddle hard, and if it's strong currents, it's really hard. So, you know, sometimes people say it's against the currents of popular culture. Popular cultures of, you know, consumerism, for example, or hate, or there's many forms of popular culture which are not so exemplary. And it's very easy to get pulled into those and get, you know, it's easier sometimes just to kind of follow along with popular culture where it goes than it is to go against them. Sometimes it's seen as the currents of greed, hate, and delusion in our own mind. It can be easier just to follow along with those than it is to say no to those. Say, no, thank you. I'm not going to follow those. I'm going to actually go in the other direction. Not only am I going to do that, I'm going to go in other direction. I'm going to cultivate the opposite of it. Or I'm going to really cultivate the capacity to let go of them and be free of them. So the Buddha was very determined to do something that he had no examples of anybody had done before him. And this something about, maybe he was a very passionate man. You know, maybe he was, so passionate people sometimes, these forces of greed, hate, and delusion, these currents, come through them very powerfully. And so he had to somehow muster tremendous effort to somehow find himself to go against the current in his own mind, in the popular minds, or wherever. Currents of his family, his father didn't want him to go off and become a monk. And so he had to somehow work against currents that in order to follow his spiritual life. And if we see some of these currents as being the internal currents that are what he's struggling with, then I think some of these is what he calls Mara. Some of these forces. Mara, the word Mara, comes from the root mur, which means death. And some people have translated the word Mara as deadening, the deadening forces in our psyche, those forces which are against life, that go against freedom in life. And it's a little bit counterintuitive, because we think sometimes if I can just follow my desires, there's life, there's energy there, I'll just be so happy. But some forces we follow and they deaden us. We become numb. So for example, it's quite obvious, like with alcoholism, pursue that desire and it's a certain kind of vitality that comes initially, but it's kind of deadening in the long term. So there's a number of desires that we can follow that are maybe deadening, forces in us that lead to our downfall, that lead us not to freedom, but to greater enslavement or something. So this is the kind of language that sometimes the Buddha used to talk about the spiritual life, making this very strong distinction between two directions that you can go in your life. In the Dhammapada, there's these verses where he says, vigilance is the path to the deathless, negligence the path to death. The vigilant do not die, the negligent are as if already dead. That's quite strong. You know, to say that vigilance can be almost synonymous with mindfulness. Mindfulness is the path to the deathless. Mindlessness is the path to death. The mindful do not die. The mindless are as if already dead. If you're not attentive and present and awake to your life, there's something about that which is deadening, or there's death already there. To spend a lifetime lost in confusion, lost in thought, lost in fantasy, there's something about the vitality in life is not quite there in the same way. So, Mara. When the Buddha was sitting on the banks of this river in India, on the brink of his enlightenment, the river is called Niranjara. He wrote this, or he said this about his period of practice, his period of exertion. So the Buddha said, to me, resolute in exertion near the river Niranjara, making a great effort, practicing meditation to attain the rest from the burden, Mara came, speaking words of compassion. Now that's really interesting. That Mara, this devil, comes speaking words of compassion. And sometimes these voices, these concerns, these drives inside of us can seemingly have our best interest in mind. So, and Mara says compassionately, concerned about the Buddha, you are ashen, thin, death is in your presence. So the Buddha had practiced very seriously, very intently, almost like as an ascetic for many years. So you can imagine he's kind of maybe quite weak. You are ashen, thin, death is in your presence. Death has 1,000 parts of you. Only one part is your life. Only 1% of life still left. Live, good sir, life is better. Alive, you can do acts of merit. You're living the holy life. You're living the holy life, performing the fire sacrifice, will heap up much merit. What use is exertion to you? Hard to follow the path of exertion, hard to do, hard to sustain. Saying these verses, Mara stood in the awakened one's presence. And to that Mara, speaking thus, the Buddha said, relative of the heedless ones, evil one, come here for whatever purpose. I haven't for merit. I haven't come here to attain merit. Even the least bit, relative of the heedless ones, evil one, I haven't for merit even the least bit of need. Those who have need of merit, those are the ones Mara's fit to address. In me are conviction, austerity, persistent discernment. Why, when I'm so resolute, do you petition me to live? This wind could burn up even river currents. Why, when I'm resolute, shouldn't my blood dry away? As my blood dries up, gall and phlegm dry up. As muscles waste away, the mind grows clear. Mindfulness, discernment, concentration stand more firm. Staying in this way, attaining the ultimate, the mind has no interest in sensual passions. So he's kind of standing up against Mara, saying, I'm not going to give in for nothing. And he's been tempted, saying, you could live a spiritual life in the old system of just going attaining lots of merit. You can do lots of good. You can do fire sacrifices and attain all this merit. And then you can get a good rebirth and it's all great. And the Buddha was not interested in that, in good rebirths. He wasn't interested in merit. He was interested in somehow discovering liberation, freedom. And he wasn't going to stop on anything short of that liberation. So there was a tremendous dedication. So again, maybe we can think of him as a very passionate man, very determined man. He describes himself as being persistent. And so he's standing up against Mara and says, no way, I'm not going to stop for nothing. And then he goes on and says, sensual passions are your first army, the armies of Mara. Your second is called discontent. Your third is hunger and thirst. Your fourth is called craving. Fifth is sloth and torpor. Sixth is called terror. Your seventh is uncertainty. Hypocrisy and stubbornness, your eighth. Gains, offerings, fame, and status, wrongly gained. And whoever would praise self and disparage others. That, Mara, is your army. The Dark One's commando force. A coward can't defeat it. But one having defeated it gains bliss. Do I carry a white flag of surrender? Death in battle would be better for me than that I, defeated, survive. That's quite strong. Seeing the bannered force on all sides, the troops of Mara, along with his mount, I go into battle. May they not budge me from my spot. That army of yours, that the world with its devas can't overcome, I will smash with wisdom, as an unfired pot is smashed with a stone. Making my resolve mastered, mindfulness well established, I will go about from kingdom to kingdom, training many disciples. They, heedful, resolute, doing my bidding, despite your wishes, will go where, having gone, there is no grief. And then Mara says, for 7 years I've dogged the Blessed One's steps, but haven't gained an opening in the one self-awakened and glorious. A crow circled a stone the color of fat and said to itself, maybe I found something tender there. Maybe there's something delicious. But not getting anything delicious from that stone, the crow went away. Like the crow attacking the rock, I weary myself with the Buddha. As he was over, And then Mara, overcome with sorrow, his lute fell from under his arm. Then the despondent spirit, right there disappeared. So this is supposed to be one of the most ancient descriptions of the struggle of Mara on the night of his enlightenment, a struggle of the Buddha the night of his enlightenment with Mara. Very strong language, very strong discussion about these forces. And the army of Mara is very interesting because you're not going to find these outside of yourself. Sensual passion. How much suffering has been caused by people in the world because of sensual passion? Tremendous amount. For all the wonderfulness of sensual desire, sensual passion has caused tremendous amount of suffering. There's no shortage of human beings who wish they hadn't listened to their sensual passion because it caused so much damage and harm. And the second is discontent. Armies of Mara, what supports Mara, what supports these deadening forces? Discontent, boredom, maybe. Hunger and thirst. Hunger and thirst is very interesting because it's physiological rather than psychological. You just be hungry and thirsty. And any parent knows that you have a little Mara on your hand if your child is hungry. It's awful. Or tired. And there's a term in English I didn't know about until I had kids called the witching hour. And that's somewhere around 4 and 5. And it's just, you know, you finally get the food in them. And so hunger and thirst is some of the things that support the forces of Mara. We get caught up, it's so easy to give up and give in. And the worst of us could come out. Then craving, sloth and torpor, terror, hypocrisy and stubbornness, doubt, and then concern with gain, offerings, fame, and status are all things that support Mara and these forces. So this is kind of strong language, but the question for each of you is, are there things in yourself, forces in yourself, that you are best not giving into? Do you notice compulsions? Do you notice desires? Do you notice fears? Do you notice hates? Do you notice directions that your mind goes that you'd actually rather not take? Behavior you do, you'd rather not do. And what is your relationship to behavior that you have, thoughts that you have, feelings that you go on, impulses that you have, that you'd rather not follow and live by? Are you able to say no? Or do you give in? And then at the end of the week you feel regret? I'm going to meditate. That's a common word for meditators, right? They say, I'm going to meditate. Okay, now I'm resolved. I'm going to get up now, I'm going to meditate every day. From now on, this is it. Well, tomorrow I'll start. tomorrow comes. And what is it that goes on? What's happening there? What are the things that get in the way of that intention? Or the intention to be a little bit kinder. Maybe some of you sometimes have a tendency to be a little bit hot-headed and would rather not snap at your friends. But you find yourself there once again snapping at someone. Something, you know, that's not you, that's not something you want to identify with, something inside of you has kind of moved through you and gotten the upper hand. So what is our relationship to those parts of ourselves which, you know, we'd rather not live by? Now what the Buddha does over and over again when Mara visits is he uses his wisdom to conquer Mara. And the wisdom primarily takes the form of seeing Mara, saying, Mara, I see you. And when Mara is seen, then Mara runs away. There's something that's very powerful in the act of seeing. And I think I'm very fond of this because seeing is not denying. And also seeing is not exactly the same thing as fighting against. It's more like fighting with yourself so that I'm not going to give in to this. I see it, I'm going to hold my own, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to give in. So it's kind of like more struggle with yourself than just struggling against something else. Okay, I'm going to hold myself and hold my seat, take my place. This is where I'm going to be. I like this verse. Like a fish out of water, thrown on dry ground, this mind trashes about, trying to escape Mara's command. Sometimes it can be that way. Sometimes the closer you get to being able to get out of the grip of Mara, grip of these forces or these currents, the more it kind of complains and argues. And you know, it's really amazing. I've watched my mind sometimes, and it's amazing. You know, I should have been a lawyer. You know, the arguments and reasons and rationale and legalities about why, you know, I should do these things that, you know, my mind sometimes wants to do. It's just trashing about, trying to escape. Greater in combat than a person who conquers. Greater in combat than a person who conquers 1,000 times 1,000 people is the person who conquers herself. That's 1,000,000 people. Right? 1,000 times 1,000 people. I mean, that's pretty good, right? My my little son, my son, both of them, you know, it's Halloween, right? So I went to his preschool this morning because they had a little Halloween parade in school, and all these kids were dressed up. And my son doesn't watch any television, so he doesn't know about a lot of things. And so he really wanted to be a bunny rabbit. So my sister sewed him a bunny rabbit costume. And now pretty much all the other boys in the class, I don't know what you know, I don't know if it was Star Wars, or I have no idea what it was, but there were these, you know, you know, some kind of, they were going to conquer the universe. You know, not just the world's too small, right? They were out there, their lasers and these masks, and it was quite, you know, something. My little son's a bunny rabbit. So you could, you know, better than conquering 1,000,000 people is conquering yourself. So my older son today, he was a pirate, and we thought he should say thank you after people give him a trick or treat, but he kept saying, "Pirates don't say thank you." In a discussion about the Eightfold Path, the verse says, "This is the path for purifying one's vision. There is no other. Follow it, and you will bewilder Mara." So we engage in a path that bewilders Mara, that confuses Mara, doesn't give Mara a chance. It is up to you to make strong effort. The Buddhas merely tell you how. Following the path, those absorbed in meditation will be freed from Mara's bonds. This I say to you, good fortune to all assembled here. Dig out the root of craving as you would the fragrant root of the birana grass. Don't let Mara destroy you again and again as a torrential river breaks a reed. So you find very strong language of this battle between forces, between Mara and Buddha, Mara and awakening, the forces that deaden us, that put us in bondage, and the forces that free us. Some people are very uncomfortable with that kind of strong dualistic language. Some people, it just doesn't taste right in their mouth to hear it and be relate to it. But somehow or other, we have to deal with these different forces within us. And how do we relate to them? And how do we work with them? And I don't think it's a very wise thing just to go along with whatever desires come up and whatever forces within us come up, bubble up. You might think that the Buddhist tradition points to a possibility of purifying oneself once and for all, so that once you become a Buddha, once you become enlightened, then you're home free. And you know, Mara will never visit, that temptation will never arise, ego will never arise, pride will never arise, lust will never arise, hate will never arise, all the different forces of Mara. And I'm not fully enlightened, so I don't know. However, if you go and look at these texts of the Buddha, then it's very interesting that Mara keeps visiting the Buddha after he's enlightened. Many stories of Mara visiting Buddha after he's enlightened. And it then really begs the question, why does Mara, what's going on? That once the Buddha is fully enlightened, why does Mara keep coming? And one interpretation of this is that Mara still, just like any other human being, has these human tendencies, these human forces that arise. But Mara is free, not from them here exactly, but from picking them up, from their influence. So a desire arises, and the Buddha sees it as a desire. Maybe hate arises in the mind of the Buddha. The Buddha sees it and says, I see it. And it doesn't go anywhere. It stops right there. Something in the clarity of seeing, where we don't buy into these forces within us. There's something in the Buddha's psyche where there's no hooks, there's no tendency to grasp or fall into some of these things, that human tendencies that bubble up. They bubble up, they're there, but they don't go anywhere. And that's maybe one definition of enlightenment, is not the absence, once and for all, of greed, hate, and delusion, though, but rather that the mind is not going to go there when they arise. There's a place of freedom, and we rest there in that freedom, and we notice the things arise, but we just don't go there. Well, so I don't know if I frightened you or bored you or what. There is this devil in Buddhism. What seems to have happened in the history of Buddhism is, as centuries went along, that the Buddhists forgot that Mara was simply a convenient symbolic way of talking about these forces inside of ourselves, and started seeing some Buddhists seeing as Mara as being something really external being, kind of a deity type person. But it seems that in the Buddha, primarily when he talked about Mara, it was really it's all a way of talking about what goes on inside, and a way of talking about it so we don't get too identified with it. We don't see it as who we really are. And so I had one more point. Maybe that's Mara's doing for me to forget. Oh, that was the point. It was that. So now maybe you want to dress up as Mara, you know, for Halloween. You know, since there's all these devils, you can dress up like a devil, right? You can figure out, you can dress up like Mara someday. The problem with that is that Mara, in the Buddhist texts, doesn't have any particular shape. Mara can take any kind of shape. Mara can be the incredibly beautiful guy, or the incredible beautiful gal. Or Mara can be a farmer in the text. Mara can be a Brahmin. Mara can be a musician. Mara can be a great general riding on a big elephant, charging into battle. Mara can take any shape and form that is useful in order to somehow trick you into going a little bit further down the current. So may you, if you can't go up current, may you at least get onto dry ground. So thank you very much.